Chapter 17 Continued.
"No Quidditch practice,"
said Angelina in hollow tones when Harry, Ron and Hermione entered the common room after dinner that night.
"But I kept my temper," said Harry, horrified. "I didn't say anything to her, Angelina. I swear I—"
I know," said Angelina miserably. "She just said she needed a bit of time to consider."
"Consider what?" said Ron angrily. "She's given the Slytherins permission. Why not us?"
But Harry could imagine how much Umbridge was enjoying holding the threat of no Gryffindor Quidditch team over their heads, and could easily understand why she would not want to relinquish that weapon over them too soon.
"Well," said Hermione, "look on the bright side. At least now you'll have time to do Snape's essay."
"That's a bright side, is it?" snapped Harry, while Ron stared incredulously at Hermione.
"No Quidditch practice and extra potions."
Harry slumped down into a chair, dragged his potions essay reluctantly from his bag, and set to work. It was very hard to concentrate. Even though he knew Sirius was not due in the fire until much later, he could not help glancing into the flames every few minutes just in case. There was also an incredible amount of noise in the room. Fred and George appeared finally to have perfected one type of skiving snack box, which they were taking turns to demonstrate to a cheering and whooping crowd. First, Fred would take a bite out of the orange end of a chew, at which he would vomit spectacularly into a bucket they had placed in front of them. Then he would force down the purple end of the chew, at which the vomiting would immediately cease. Lee Jordan, who was assisting the demonstration, was lazily vanishing the vomit at regular intervals with the same vanishing spell Snape kept using on Harry's potions. What with the regular sounds of retching, cheering, and the sound of Fred and George taking advance orders from the crowd, Harry was finding it exceptionally difficult to focus on the correct method for strengthening solution. Hermione was not helping matters. The cheers and the sound of vomit hitting the bottom of Fred and George's bucket were punctuated by her loud and disapproving sniffs, which Harry found, if anything, more distracting.
"Just go and stop them, then,"
he said irritably, after crossing out the wrong weight of powdered griffin claw for the fourth time.
"I can't. They're not technically doing anything wrong," said Hermione through gritted teeth. "They're quite within their rights to eat the foul things themselves, and I can't find a rule that says the other idiots aren't entitled to buy them, not unless they're proven to be dangerous in some way, and it doesn't look as though they are."
She, Harry and Ron watched George projectile vomit into the bucket, gulp down the rest of the chew, and straighten up, beaming with his arms wide, to protracted applause.
"You know, I don't get why Fred and George only got 3 OWLs each," said Harry, watching as Fred, George and Lee collected gold from the eager crowd. "They really know their stuff."
"Oh, they only know flashy stuff that's of no real use to anyone," said Hermione disparagingly.
"No real use," said Ron in a strained voice. "Hermione, they've made about 26 galleons already."
It was a long while before the crowd around the Weasley twins dispersed. Then Fred, Lee and George sat up counting their takings even longer, so it was well past midnight when Harry, Ron and Hermione finally had the common room to themselves. At long last, Fred had closed the doorway to the boys' dormitories behind him, rattling his box of galleons ostentatiously so that Hermione scowled. Harry, who was making very little progress with his potions essay, decided to give it up for the night. As he put his books away, Ron, who was dozing lightly in an armchair, gave a muffled grunt, awoke, and looked blearily into the fire.
"Sirius," he said.
Harry whipped round. Sirius's untidy dark head was sitting in the fire again.
"Hi," he said, grinning.
"Hi,"
chorused Harry, Ron and Hermione, all three kneeling down on the hearthrug. Crookshanks purred loudly and approached the fire, trying, despite the heat, to put his face close to Sirius's.
"How are things?" said Sirius.
"Not that good," said Harry, as Hermione pulled Crookshanks back to stop him singeing his whiskers.
The Ministry's forced through another decree, which means we're not allowed to have Quidditch teams.
Or secret defence against the dark arts groups, said Sirius.
There was a short pause.
How did you know about that? Harry demanded.
You want to choose your meeting places more carefully, said Sirius, grinning still more broadly. The Hog's Head, I ask you.
Well, it was better than the Three Broomsticks, said Hermione defensively. That's always packed with people.
Which means you'd have been harder to overhear, said Sirius. You've got a lot to learn, Hermione.
Who overheard us? Harry demanded.
Mundungus, of course, said Sirius.
And when they all looked puzzled, he laughed.
He was the witch under the veil.
That was Mundungus, Harry said, stunned. What was he doing in the Hog's Head?
What do you think he was doing? Said Sirius impatiently. Keeping an eye on you, of course.
I'm still being followed? Asked Harry angrily.
Yeah, you are, said Sirius. And just as well, isn't it, if the first thing you're going to do on your weekend off is organize an illegal defense group?
But he looked neither angry nor worried. On the contrary, he was looking at Harry with distinct pride.
Why was Dung hiding from us? Asked Ron, sounding disappointed. We'd have liked to have seen him.
He was banned from the Hogshead 20 years ago, said Sirius, and that barman's got a long memory. We lost Moody's spare invisibility cloak when Sturgis was arrested, so Dung's been dressing as a witch a lot lately. Anyway, first of all, Ron, I've sworn to pass on a message from your mother.
Oh, yeah, said Ron, sounding apprehensive.
She says, on no account whatsoever are you to take part in an illegal, secret defence against the dark arts group. She says you'll be expelled for sure, and your future will be ruined. She says there will be plenty of time to learn how to defend yourself later, and that you are too young to be worrying about that right now. She also, Sirius's eyes turned to the other two, advises Harry and Hermione not to proceed with the group, though she accepts that she has no authority over either of them, and simply begs them to remember that she has their best interests at heart. She would have written all this to you, but if the owl had been intercepted, you'd all have been in real trouble, and she can't say it for herself, because she's on duty tonight.
On duty doing what? Said Ron quickly.
Never you mind. Just stuff for the order, said Sirius. So it's fallen to me to be the messenger, and make sure you tell her I passed it all on, because I don't think she trusts me to.
There was another pause, in which Crookshanks, mewing, attempted to paw Sirius's head, and Ron fiddled with a hole in the hearthrug.
So you want me to say I'm not going to take part in the defence group? He muttered, finally.
Me? Certainly not, said Sirius, looking surprised. I think it's an excellent idea.
You do? Said Harry, his heart lifting.
Of course I do, said Sirius. Do you think your father and I would have lain down and taken orders from an old hag like Umbridge?
But last term all you did was tell me to be careful and not take risks. Last year all the evidence was that someone inside Hogwarts was trying to kill you, Harry, said Sirius impatiently.
This year we know there's someone outside Hogwarts who'd like to kill us all, so I think learning to defend yourselves properly is a very good idea.
And if we do get expelled? Hermione asked, a quizzical look on her face.
Hermione, this whole thing was your idea, said Harry, staring at her.
I know it was. I just wondered what Sirius thought, she said, shrugging.
Well, better expelled and able to defend yourselves than sitting safely in school without a clue, said Sirius.
Hear, hear, said Harry and Ron enthusiastically.
So, said Sirius, how are you organizing this group?
Where are you meeting?
Well, that's a bit of a problem now, said Harry. Don't know where we're going to be able to go.
How about the Shrieking Shack? Suggested Sirius.
Hey, that's an idea, said Ron excitedly.
But Hermione made a sceptical noise, and all three of them looked at her, Sirius's head turning in the flames.
"Well, Sirius, it's just that there were only four of you meeting in the Shrieking Shack when you were at school," said Hermione, "and all of you could transform into animals,
and I suppose you could all have squeezed under a single invisibility cloak if you'd wanted to. But there are 28 of us, and none of us is an animagus, so we wouldn't need so much an invisibility cloak as an invisibility marquee.
Fair point, said Sirius, looking slightly crestfallen.
Well, I'm sure you'll come up with somewhere.
There used to be a pretty roomy secret passageway behind that big mirror on the fourth floor. You might have enough space to practice jinxes in there.
Fred and George told me it's blocked, said Harry, shaking his head. Caved in or something.
Oh, said Sirius, frowning. Well, I'll have a think and get back to...
He broke off. His face was suddenly tense, alarmed. He turned sideways, apparently looking into the solid brick wall of the fireplace.
Sirius? Said Harry anxiously.
But he had vanished. Harry gaped at the flames for a moment, then turned to look at Ron and Hermione.
Why did he...
Hermione gave a horrified gasp and leapt to her feet, still staring at the fire. A hand had appeared amongst the flames, groping as though to catch hold of something. A stubby, short-fingered hand, covered in ugly, old-fashioned rings. The three of them ran for it. At the door of the boys' dormitory, Harry looked back. Umbridge's hand was still making snatching movements amongst the flames, as though she knew exactly where Sirius's hair had been moments before, and was determined to seize it.
Chapter 18. Dumbledore's Army.
Umbridge has been reading your mail, Harry. There's no other explanation.
You think Umbridge attacked Hedwig? He said, outraged.
I'm almost certain of it, said Hermione grimly.
Watch your frog. It's escaping.
Harry pointed his wand at the bullfrog that had been hopping hopefully towards the other side of the table. Axio. And it zoomed gloomily back into his hand.
Charms was always one of the best lessons in which to enjoy a private chat. There was generally so much movement and activity that the danger of being overheard was very slight. Today, with the room full of croaking bullfrogs and cawing ravens, and with a heavy downpour of rain clattering and pounding against the classroom windows, Harry, Ron and Hermione's whispered discussion about how Umbridge had nearly caught Sirius went quite unnoticed.
"I've been suspecting this ever since Filch accused you of ordering dung bombs, because it seemed such a stupid lie," Hermione whispered. "I mean, once your letter had been read, it would have been quite clear you weren't ordering them. So you wouldn't have been in trouble at all. It's a bit of a feeble joke, isn't it? But then I thought, what if somebody just wanted an excuse to read your mail? Well, then, it would be a perfect way for Umbridge to manage it. Tip off Filch, let him do the dirty work and confiscate the letter. Then either find a way of stealing it from him or else demand to see it. I don't think Filch would object. When's he ever stuck up for a student's rights? Harry, you're squashing your frog.
Harry looked down. He was indeed squeezing his bullfrog so tightly its eyes were popping. He replaced it hastily upon the desk.
"It was a very, very close call last night," said Hermione. "I just wonder if Umbridge knows how close it was."
"Silencio!"
The bullfrog on which she was practising her silencing charm was struck dumb mid-croak and glared at her reproachfully.
"If she'd caught Snuffles,"
Harry finished the sentence for her, "he'd probably be back in Azkaban this morning." He waved his wand without really concentrating. His bullfrog swelled like a green balloon and emitted a high-pitched whistle.
"Silencio!"
said Hermione hastily, pointing her wand at Harry's frog, which deflated silently before them.
"Well, he mustn't do it again, that's all. I just don't know how we're going to let him know. We can't send him an owl."
"I don't reckon he'll risk it again," said Ron. "He's not stupid. He knows she nearly got him. Silencio!"
The large and ugly raven in front of him let out a derisive caw.
"Silencio! Silencio!"
The raven cawed more loudly.
"It's the way you're moving your wand," said Hermione, watching Ron critically. "You don't want to wave it. It's more a sharp jab."
"'Ravens are harder than frogs,' said Ron testily.
"'Fine, let's swap,' said Hermione, "'seizing Ron's raven and replacing it with her own fat bullfrog.
"'Silencio!'
"'The raven continued to open and close its sharp beak, "'but no sound came out.
"'Very good, Miss Granger,'
said Professor Flitwick's squeaky little voice, "'making Harry, Ron and Hermione all jump.
"'Now, let me see you try, Mr. Weasley.'
"'What? Oh, right,' said Ron, very flustered. "'Silencio!'
"'He jabbed at the bullfrog so hard he poked it in the eye. "'The frog gave a deafening croak and leapt off the desk. "'It came as no surprise to any of them "'that Harry and Ron were given additional practice "'of the silencing charm for homework. "'They were allowed to remain inside over break "'due to the downpour outside. "'They found seats in a noisy and overcrowded classroom "'on the first floor in which Peeves was floating "'dreamily up near the chandelier, "'occasionally blowing an ink pellet at the top of somebody's head.' They had barely sat down when Angelina came struggling towards them through the groups of gossiping students.
"'I've got permission,' she said, "'to reform the Quidditch team.'
"'Excellent,' said Ron and Harry together.
"'Yeah,' said Angelina, beaming. "'I went to McGonagall, and I think she might have appealed to Dumbledore. "'Anyway, Umbridge had to give in.
"'Ha! So I want you down at the pitch at 7 o'clock tonight, all right? "'Because we've got to make up time.' "'You realise we're only 3 weeks away from our first match?'
"'She squeezed away from them, narrowly dodged an ink pellet from Peeves, "'which hit a nearby first year instead, and vanished from sight. "'Ron's smile slipped slightly as he looked out of the window, "'which was now opaque with hammering rain. "'Hope this clears up. "'What's up with you, Hermione?' "'She too was gazing at the window, but not as though she really saw it. Her eyes were unfocused, and there was a frown on her face. "'Just thinking,' she said, still frowning at the rain-washed window. "'About Snuffles,' said Harry.
"'No, not exactly,' said Hermione slowly. "'More wondering... I suppose we're doing the right thing, I think. Aren't we?'
Harry and Ron looked at each other.
"'Well, that clears that up,' said Ron. "'It would have been really annoying if you hadn't explained yourself properly.'
"'Hermione looked at him as though she had only just realised he was there.
"'I was just wondering,' she said, her voice stronger now, "'whether we're doing the right thing, starting this Defence Against the Dark Arts group.'
"'What?' said Harry and Ron together.
"'Hermione, it was your idea in the first place,' said Ron indignantly.
"'No,' said Hermione, twisting her fingers together. "'But after talking to Snuffles—'
"'But he's all for it,' said Harry.
"'Yes,' said Hermione, staring at the window again.
"'Yes, that's what made me think maybe it wasn't a good idea after all.'
Peeves floated over them on his stomach, pea-shooter at the ready. Automatically all three of them lifted their bags to cover their heads until he had passed.
"'Let's get this straight,' said Harry angrily, as they put their bags back on the floor. "'Sirius agrees with us, so you don't think we should do it any more.'
Hermione looked tense and rather miserable. Now, staring at her own hands, she said, "'Do you honestly trust his judgment?'
"'Yes, I do,' said Harry at once. "'He's always given us great advice.'
An ink pellet whizzed past them, striking Katie Bell squarely in the ear. Hermione watched Katie leap to her feet and start throwing things at Peeves. It was a few moments before Hermione spoke again, and it sounded as though she was choosing her words very carefully.
"'You don't think he has become sort of reckless since he's been cooped up in grim old place? You don't think he's kind of living through us?'
"'What do you mean, living through us?' Harry retorted.
"'I mean, well, I think he'd love to be forming secret defence societies "'right under the nose of someone from the Ministry. "'I think he's really frustrated at how little he can do where he is. "'So I think he's keen to kind of egg us on.'
"'Ron looked utterly perplexed.
"'Sirius is right,' he said. "'You do sound just like my mother.'
"'Hermione bit her lip and did not answer.'
The bell rang just as Peeves swooped down on Katie and emptied an entire ink bottle over her head. The weather did not improve as the day wore on, so that at 7 o'clock that evening, when Harry and Ron went down to the Quidditch pitch for practice, they were soaked through within minutes, their feet slipping and sliding on the sodden grass. The sky was a deep, thundery grey, and it was a relief to gain the warmth and light of the changing rooms, even if they knew the respite was only temporary. They found Fred and George debating whether to use one of their own skiving snack boxes to get out of flying. "But I bet you'd know what we'd done," Fred said out of the corner of his mouth. "If only I hadn't offered to sell her some puking pastels yesterday."
"We could try the fever fudge," George muttered. "No one's seen that yet."
"Does it work?" inquired Ron hopefully, as the hammering of rain on the roof intensified and wind howled around the building.
"Well, yeah," said Fred. "Your temperature'll go right up."
"But you get these massive pus-filled boils, too," said George, "and we haven't worked out how to get rid of them yet."
"I can't see any boils," said Ron, staring at the twins.
"No, well, you wouldn't," said Fred, darkly. "They're not in a place we generally display to the public. But they make sitting on a broom a right pain in the—"
"All right, everyone, listen up," said Angelina loudly, emerging from the captain's office. "I know it's not ideal weather, but there's a chance we'll be playing Slytherin in conditions like this, so it's a good idea to work out how we're going to cope with them. Harry, didn't you do something to your glasses to stop the rain fogging them up when we played Hufflepuff in that storm?"
"Hermione did it," said Harry. He pulled out his wand, tapped his glasses, and said, "Impervious!"
"I think we all ought to try that," said Angelina. "If we could just keep the rain off our faces, it would really help visibility. All together, come on. Impervious!
Okay, let's go." They all stowed their wands back in the inside pockets of their robes, shouldered their brooms, and followed Angelina out of the changing rooms. They squelched through the deepening mud to the middle of the pitch. Visibility was still very poor, even with the impervious charm. Light was fading fast, and curtains of rain were sweeping the grounds.
"All right, on my whistle!" shouted Angelina.
Harry kicked off from the ground, spraying mud in all directions, and shot upwards, the wind pulling him slightly off course. He had no idea how he was going to see the Snitch in this weather. He was having enough difficulty seeing the one bludger with which they were practising. A minute into the practice, it almost unseated him, and he had to use the sloth grip roll to avoid it. Unfortunately, Angelina did not see this. In fact, she did not appear to be able to see anything. None of them had a clue what the others were doing. The wind was picking up. Even at a distance, Harry could hear the swishing, pounding sounds of the rain pummeling the surface of the lake. Angelina kept them at it for nearly an hour before conceding defeat. She led her sodden and disgruntled team back into the changing rooms, insisting that the practice had not been a waste of time, though without any real conviction in her voice. Fred and George were looking particularly annoyed. Both were bandy-legged and winced with every movement. Harry could hear them complaining in low voices as he toweled his hair dry.
"I think a few of mine have ruptured," said Fred in a hollow voice.
"Mine haven't," said George, wincing. "They're throbbing like mad. Feel bigger, if anything."
"Ouch!"
said Harry. He pressed the towel to his face, his eyes screwed tight with pain. The scar on his forehead had seared again, more painfully than it had in weeks.
"What's up?"
said several voices. Harry emerged from behind his towel. The changing room was blurred because he was not wearing his glasses, but he could still tell that everyone's face was turned towards him.
"Nothing," he muttered. I poked myself in the eye, that's all."
But he gave Ron a significant look, and the two of them hung back as the rest of the team filed back outside, muffled in their cloaks, their hats pulled low over their ears.
"What happened?"
said Ron the moment Alicia had disappeared through the door.
"Was it your scar?"
Harry nodded.
"But—"
Looking scared, Ron strode across to the window and stared out into the rain.
He can't be near us now, can he?"
"'No,'
Harry muttered, sinking onto a bench and rubbing his forehead. "'He's probably miles away. It hurt because he's angry.' Harry had not meant to say that at all, and heard the words as though a stranger had spoken them, yet knew at once that they were true. He did not know how he knew it, but he did. Voldemort, wherever he was, whatever he was doing, was in a towering temper.
"'Did you see him?' said Ron, looking horrified. "'Did you get a vision or something?'
Harry sat quite still, staring at his feet, allowing his mind and his memory to relax in the aftermath of the pain. A confused tangle of shapes, a howling rush of voices. "'He wants something done, and it's not happening fast enough,' he said. Again he felt surprised to hear the words coming out of his mouth, and yet was quite certain they were true.
"'But how do you know?' said Ron.
Harry shook his head and covered his eyes with his hands, pressing down upon them with his palms. Little stars erupted in them. He felt Ron sit down on the bench beside him and knew Ron was staring at him.
"'Is this what it was about last time?' said Ron in a hushed voice. "'When your scar hurt in Umbridge's office, you know who was angry?'
Harry shook his head.
"'What is it, then?'
Harry was thinking himself back. He had been looking into Umbridge's face. His scar had hurt, and he had had that odd feeling in his stomach, a strange leaping feeling, a happy feeling. But of course he had not recognised it for what it was, as he had been feeling so miserable himself. "'Last time, it was because he was pleased,' he said, "'really pleased. He thought something good was going to happen, "'and the night before we came back to Hogwarts,' "'he thought back to the moment when his scar had hurt so badly "'in his and Ron's bedroom in Grim Old Place. "'He was furious. "'He looked round at Ron, who was gaping at him.
"'You could take over from Trelawney, mate,' he said, in an awed voice.
"'I'm not making prophecies,' said Harry.
"'No, you know what you're doing,' Ron said, sounding both scared and impressed. "'Harry,
you're reading you-know-who's mind.'
"'No,' said Harry, shaking his head. "'It's more like his mood, I suppose. "'I'm just getting flashes of what mood he's in.' "'Dumbledore said something like this was happening last year. "'He said that when Voldemort was near me, "'or when he was feeling hatred, I could tell. "'Well, now I'm feeling it when he's pleased, too.' "'There was a pause. "'The wind and rain lashed at the building.
"'You've got to tell someone,' said Ron.
"'I told Sirius last time. "'Well, tell him about this time.'
"'Can't, can I?' said Harry grimly. "'Umbridge is watching the owls and the fires, remember?'
"'Well then, Dumbledore!' "'I've just told you. He already knows,' said Harry shortly, getting to his feet, taking his cloak off his peg, and swinging it around him. "'There's no point telling him again.'
Ron did up the fastening of his own cloak, watching Harry thoughtfully.
"'Dumbledore'd want to know,' he said.
Harry shrugged.
"'Come on!' We've still got silencing charms to practice.
They hurried back through the dark grounds, sliding and stumbling up the muddy lawns, not talking. Harry was thinking hard.
What was it that Voldemort wanted done that was not happening quickly enough?
He's got other plans. Plans he can put into operation very quietly indeed. Stuff he can only get by stealth, like a weapon. Something he didn't have last time.
Harry had not thought about those words in weeks. He had been too absorbed in what was going on at Hogwarts, too busy dwelling on the ongoing battles with Umbridge, the injustice of all the ministry interference. But now they came back to him and made him wonder. Voldemort's anger would make sense if he was no nearer to laying hands on the weapon, whatever it was. Had the order thwarted him, stopped him from seizing it? Where was it kept? Who had it now?
"Mimbulus Mimbletonia," said Ron's voice, and Harry came back to his senses just in time to clamber through the portrait hole into the common room. It appeared that Hermione had gone to bed early, leaving Crookshanks curled in a nearby chair and an assortment of knobbly knitted elf hats lying on a table by the fire. Harry was rather grateful that she was not around, because he did not much want to discuss his scar hurting and have her urge him to go to Dumbledore too. Ron kept throwing him anxious glances, but Harry pulled out his charms book and set to work on finishing his essay, though he was only pretending to concentrate, and by the time Ron said he was going up to bed too, he had written hardly anything. Midnight came and went, while Harry was reading and re-reading a passage about the uses of scurvy grass, lovage and sneezewort, and not taking in a word of it. "These plants are most efficacious in the inflaming of the brain, and are therefore much used in confusing and befuddlement draughts, where the wizard is desirous of producing hot-headedness and recklessness." Hermione said Sirius was becoming reckless, cooped up in Grim Old Place. "Most efficacious in the inflaming of the brain, and are therefore much used..." The Daily Prophet would think his brain was inflamed if they found out that he knew what Voldemort was feeling. "Therefore much used in confusing and befuddlement drafts." Confusing was the word, all right. Why did he know what Voldemort was feeling? What was this weird connection between them which Dumbledore had never been able to explain satisfactorily? "Where the wizard is desirous..." How Harry would like to sleep. "Of producing hot-headedness." It was warm and comfortable in his armchair before the fire, with the rain still beating heavily on the window panes, Crookshanks purring, and the crackling of the flames. The book slipped from Harry's slack grip and landed with a dull thud on the hearthrug. His head lolled sideways. He was walking once more along a windowless corridor, his footsteps echoing in the silence. As the door at the end of the passage loomed larger, his heart beat fast with excitement. If he could only open it, enter beyond. He stretched out his hand. His fingertips were inches from it.
"Harry Potter, sir!"
He awoke with a start. The candles had all been extinguished in the common room, but there was something moving close by.
"Who's there?"
said Harry, sitting upright in his chair. The fire was almost out, the room very dark.
"Dobby has your owl, sir,"
said a squeaky voice.
"Dobby?"
said Harry thickly, peering through the gloom towards the source of the voice. Dobby the house elf was standing beside the table on which Hermione had left half a dozen of her knitted hats. His large, pointed ears were now sticking out from beneath what looked like all the hats Hermione had ever knitted. He was wearing one on top of the other, so that his head seemed elongated by 2 or 3 feet, and on the very topmost bobble sat Hedwig, hooting serenely and obviously cured.
"Dobby volunteered to return Harry Potter's owl,"
said the elf squeakily, with a look of positive adoration on his face.
"Professor Grubbly Plank says she is all well now, sir."
He sank into a deep bow, so that his pencil-like nose brushed the threadbare surface of the hearthrug, and Hedwig gave an indignant hoot and fluttered onto the arm of Harry's chair. "Thanks, Dobby," said Harry, stroking Hedwig's head and blinking hard, trying to rid himself of the image of the door in his dream. It had been very vivid. Looking back at Dobby, he noticed that the elf was also wearing several scarves and innumerable socks, so that his feet looked far too big for his body.
"Have you been taking all the clothes Hermione's been leaving out?" "Oh, no, sir,"
said Dobby happily.
"Dobby has been taking some for Winky, too, sir."
"Yeah, how is Winky?" asked Harry. Dobby's ears drooped slightly.
"Winky is still drinking lots, sir,"
he said sadly, his enormous round green eyes, large as tennis balls, downcast.
"She still does not care for clothes, Harry Potter, nor do the other house elves. None of them will clean Gryffindor Tower any more, not with the hats and socks hidden everywhere. They find them insulting, sir. Dobby does it all himself, sir, but Dobby does not mind, sir, for he always hopes to meet Harry Potter. And tonight, sir, he has got his wish."
Dobby sank into a deep bow again.
"But Harry Potter does not seem happy,"
Dobby went on, straightening up again and looking timidly at Harry.
"Dobby heard him muttering in his sleep. Was Harry Potter having bad dreams?"
"Not really bad,"
said Harry, yawning and rubbing his eyes.
"I've had worse."
The elf surveyed Harry out of his vast, orb-like eyes. Then he said very seriously, his ears drooping,
"Dobby wishes he could help Harry Potter, for Harry Potter set Dobby free, and Dobby is much, much happier now."
Harry smiled. "You can't help me, Dobby, but thanks for the offer." He bent and picked up his potions book. He'd have to try to finish the essay tomorrow. He closed the book, and as he did so, the firelight illuminated the thin white scars on the back of his hand, the result of his detentions with Umbridge. "Wait a moment. There is something you can do for me, Dobby," said Harry slowly. The elf looked round, beaming.
"Name it, Harry Potter, sir."
"I need to find a place where 28 people can practice defence against the dark arts without being discovered by any of the teachers. Especially," Harry clenched his hand on the book so that the scars shone pearly white, "Professor Umbridge." He expected the elf smile to vanish, his ears to droop. He expected him to say it was impossible, or else that he would try to find somewhere, but his hopes were not high. What he had not expected was for Dobby to give a little skip, his ears waggling cheerfully, and clap his hands together.
"Dobby knows the perfect place, sir," he said happily. "Dobby heard tell of it from the other house elves when he came to Hogwarts, sir. It is known by us as the come-and-go room, sir, or else as the room of requirement."
"Why?" said Harry curiously.
"Because it is a room that a person can only enter," said Dobby seriously, "when they have real need of it. Sometimes it is there, and sometimes it is not, but when it appears, it is always equipped for the seeker's needs." "Dobby has used it, sir,"
said the elf, dropping his voice and looking guilty.
"When Winky has been very drunk, he has hidden her in the room of requirement, and he has found antidotes to butterbeer there, and a nice elf-sized bed to settle her on while she sleeps it off, sir. And Dobby knows Mr. Filch has found extra cleaning materials there when he has run short, sir, and
if you really needed a bathroom," said Harry, suddenly remembering something Dumbledore had said at the Yule Ball the previous Christmas. "Would it fill itself with chamber pots?"
"Dobby expects so, sir," said Dobby, nodding earnestly. "It is a most amazing room, sir."
"How many people know about it?" said Harry, sitting up straighter in his chair.
"Very few, sir. Mostly people stumbles across it when they needs it, sir. But often they never finds it again, for they do not know that it is always there, waiting to be called into service, sir."
"It sounds brilliant," said Harry, his heart racing. "It sounds perfect, Dobby. When can you show me where it is?"
"Any time, Harry Potter, sir,"
said Dobby, looking delighted at Harry's enthusiasm.
"We could go now, if you like."
For a moment, Harry was tempted to go with Dobby. He was halfway out of his seat, intending to hurry upstairs for his invisibility cloak, when, not for the first time, a voice very much like Hermione's whispered in his ear, "Reckless." It was, after all, very late. He was exhausted and had Snape's essay to finish. "Not tonight, Dobby," said Harry reluctantly, sinking back into his chair. "This is really important. I don't want to blow it. It'll need proper planning. Listen,
Can you just tell me exactly where this room of requirement is and how to get in there?
Their robes billowed and swirled around them as they splashed across the flooded vegetable patch to double herbology, where they could hardly hear what Professor Sprout was saying over the hammering of raindrops hard as hailstones on the greenhouse roof. The afternoon's Care of Magical Creatures lesson was to be relocated from the storm-swept grounds to a free classroom on the ground floor, and, to their intense relief, Angelina had sought out her team at lunch to tell them that Quidditch practice was cancelled.
"Good," said Harry quietly when she told him, "because we've found somewhere to have our first defence meeting. Tonight, 8 o'clock, 7th floor, opposite that tapestry of Barnabas the Barmy being clubbed by those trolls. Can you tell Katie and Alicia?"
She looked slightly taken aback, but promised to tell the others. Harry returned hungrily to his sausages and mash. When he looked up to take a drink of pumpkin juice, he found Hermione watching him.
"What?" he said thickly.
"Well, it's just that Dobby's plans aren't always that safe. Don't you remember when he lost you all the bones in your arm?
This room isn't just some mad idea of Dobby's. Dumbledore knows about it too. He mentioned it to me at the Yule Ball."
Hermione's expression cleared.
"Dumbledore told you about it?"
"Just in passing," said Harry, shrugging.
"Oh, well, that's all right then," said Hermione briskly, and raised no more objections.
Together with Ron, they had spent most of the day seeking out those people who had signed their names to the list in the Hogshead and telling them where to meet that evening. Somewhat to Harry's disappointment, it was Ginny who managed to find Cho Chang and her friend first. However, by the end of dinner, he was confident that the news had been passed to every one of the 25 people who had turned up in the Hogshead. At 7:30, Harry, Ron and Hermione left the Gryffindor common room, Harry clutching a certain piece of aged parchment in his hand. 5th years were allowed to be out in the corridors until 9 o'clock, but all three of them kept looking around nervously as they made their way along the 7th floor.
"Hold it," Harry warned, unfolding the piece of parchment at the top of the last staircase, tapping it with his wand and muttering, "I solemnly swear that I am up to no good."
A map of Hogwarts appeared on the blank surface of the parchment. Tiny, black moving dots, labelled with names, showed where various people were.
"Filch is on the 2nd floor, said Harry, holding the map close to his eyes, "and Mrs. Norris is on the 4th.
"And Umbridge?" said Hermione anxiously.
"In her office," said Harry, pointing.
"Okay, let's go."
They hurried along the corridor to the place Dobby had described to Harry. A stretch of blank wall opposite an enormous tapestry depicting Barnabas the Barmy's foolish attempt to train trolls for the ballet.
"Okay," said Harry quietly, while a moth-eaten troll paused in his relentless clubbing of the would-be ballet teacher to watch them.
"Dobby said to walk past this bit of wall 3 times, concentrating hard on what we need." They did so, turning sharply at the window just beyond the blank stretch of wall, then at the man-sized vase on its other side. Ron had screwed up his eyes in concentration. Hermione was whispering something under her breath. Harry's fists were clenched as he stared ahead of him.
"We need somewhere to learn to fight," he thought. "Just give us a place to practice, somewhere they can't find us."
"Harry," said Hermione sharply, as they wheeled around after their 3rd walk past.
A highly polished door had appeared in the wall. Ron was staring at it, looking slightly wary. Harry reached out, seized the brass handle, pulled open the door, and led the way into a spacious room lit with flickering torches like those that illuminated the dungeons 8 floors below. The walls were lined with wooden bookcases, and instead of chairs, there were large silk cushions on the floor. A set of shelves at the far end of the room carried a range of instruments, such as sneakerscopes, secrecy sensors, and a large cracked faux glass that Harry was sure had hung the previous year in the fake Moody's office.
"These will be good when we're practising stunning," said Ron enthusiastically, prodding one of the cushions with his foot.
"And just look at these books," said Hermione excitedly, running a finger along the spines of the large leather-bound tomes. "A compendium of common curses and their counteractions, the dark arts outsmarted, self-defensive spell work. Wow!"
She looked around at Harry, her face glowing, and he saw that the presence of hundreds of books had finally convinced Hermione that what they were doing was right.
"Harry, this is wonderful. There's everything we need here."
And without further ado, she slid Jinxes for the Jinxed from its shelf, sank onto the nearest cushion, and began to read. There was a gentle knock on the door. Harry looked round. Ginny, Neville, Lavender, Parvati, and Dean had arrived.
"Whoa," said Dean, staring around, impressed. "What is this place?"
Harry began to explain. But before he had finished, more people had arrived, and he had to start all over again. By the time 8 o'clock arrived, every cushion was occupied. Harry moved across to the door and turned the key protruding from the lock. It clicked in a satisfyingly loud way, and everybody fell silent, looking at him. Hermione carefully marked her page of Jinxes for the Jinxed and set the book aside.
"Well," said Harry, slightly nervously, "this is the place we found for practice sessions, and you've, obviously found it okay."
"It's fantastic," said Cho,
and several people murmured their agreement.
"It's bizarre," said Fred, frowning around at it. "We once hid from Filch in here, remember, George? But it was just a broom cupboard then." "Hey, Harry, what's this stuff?"
asked Dean from the rear of the room, indicating the sneakerscopes and the faux glass. "Dark detectors," said Harry, stepping between the cushions to reach them.
"Basically, they all show when dark wizards or enemies are around. But you don't want to rely on them too much. They can be fooled."
He gazed for a moment into the cracked faux glass. Shadowy figures were moving around inside it, though none was recognizable. He turned his back on it.
"Well, I've been thinking about the sort of stuff we ought to do first, and,
He noticed a raised hand. "What, Hermione?"
"I think we ought to elect a leader," said Hermione.
"Harry's leader?"
said Cho at once, looking at Hermione as though she were mad. Harry's stomach did yet another backflip.
"Yes, but I think we ought to vote on it properly," said Hermione, unperturbed. "It makes it formal, and it gives him authority. So, everyone who thinks Harry ought to be our leader."
Everybody put up their hand, even Zacharias Smith, though he did it very half-heartedly.
Right, thanks," said Harry, who could feel his face burning.
"And what, Hermione?"
"I also think we ought to have a name,"
she said brightly, her hand still in the air.
"It would promote a feeling of team spirit and unity, don't you think?"
"Can we be the Anti-Umbridge League?"
said Angelina, hopefully.
"Or the Ministry of Magic Our Morons group?"
suggested Fred.
"I was thinking," said Hermione, frowning at Fred, "more of a name that didn't tell everyone what we were up to, so we can refer to it safely outside meetings." "The Defence Association," said Cho. "The DA, for short, so nobody knows what we're talking about."
"Yeah, the DA's good," said Ginny, "only let's make it stand for Dumbledore's Army, because that's the Ministry's worst fear, isn't it?"
There was a good deal of appreciative murmuring and laughter at this.
"All in favour of the DA,"
said Hermione bossily, kneeling up on her cushion to count.
"That's a majority. Motion passed."
She pinned the piece of parchment with all of their signatures on it onto the wall and wrote across the top, in large letters, "Dumbledore's Army."
"Right," said Harry, when she had sat down again. "Shall we get practising, then? I was thinking, the first thing we should do is Expelliarmus, you know, the disarming charm. I know it's pretty basic, but I found it really useful."
"Oh, please,"
said Zacharias Smith, rolling his eyes and folding his arms.
"I don't think Expelliarmus is exactly going to help us against you-know-who, do you?"
"I've used it against him,"
said Harry quietly. "It saved my life in June." Smith opened his mouth stupidly. The rest of the room was very quiet. "But if you think it's beneath you, you can leave," Harry said. Smith did not move, nor did anybody else. "Okay," said Harry, his mouth slightly drier than usual, with all these eyes upon him. "I reckon we should all divide into pairs and practice." It felt very odd to be issuing instructions, but not nearly as odd as seeing them followed. Everybody got to their feet at once and divided up. Predictably, Neville was left partnerless. "You can practice with me," Harry told him. "Right. On the count of three, then. 1, 2, 3. The room was suddenly full of shouts of Expelliarmus. Wands flew in all directions. Mist spells hit books on shelves and sent them flying into the air. Harry was too quick for Neville, whose wand went spinning out of his hand, hit the ceiling in a shower of sparks, and landed with a clatter on top of a bookshelf, from which Harry retrieved it with a summoning charm. Glancing around, he thought he had been right to suggest they practice the basics first. There was a lot of shoddy spell work going on. Many people were not succeeding in disarming their opponents at all, but merely causing them to jump backwards a few paces, or wince as their feeble spell whooshed over them. "Expelliarmus!" said Neville, and Harry, caught unawares, felt his wand fly out of his hand. "I did it!" said Neville gleefully. "I've never done it before. I did it!" "Good one!" said Harry encouragingly, deciding not to point out that in a real duel Neville's opponent was unlikely to be staring in the opposite direction with his wand held loosely at his side. "Listen, Neville, can you take it in turns to practice with Ron and Hermione for a couple of minutes so I can walk around and see how the rest are doing?" Harry moved off into the middle of the room. Something very odd was happening to Zacharias Smith. Every time he opened his mouth to disarm Anthony Goldstein, his own wand would fly out of his hand, yet Anthony did not seem to be making a sound. Harry did not have to look far to solve the mystery. Fred and George were several feet from Smith, and taking it in turns to point their wands at his back. "Sorry, Harry," said George hastily when Harry caught his eye. "Couldn't resist." Harry walked around the other pairs, trying to correct those who were doing the spell wrong. Ginny was teamed with Michael Corner. She was doing very well, whereas Michael was either very bad or unwilling to jinx her. Ernie Macmillan was flourishing his wand unnecessarily, giving his partner time to get in under his guard. The Creevy brothers were enthusiastic but erratic, and mainly responsible for all the books leaping off the shelves around them. Luna Lovegood was similarly patchy, occasionally sending Justin Finch Fletchley's wand spinning out of his hand, at other times merely causing his hair to stand on end. "Okay, stop," Harry shouted. "Stop! Stop!" "I need a whistle," he thought, and immediately spotted one lying on top of the nearest row of books. He caught it up and blew hard. Everyone lowered their wands. "That wasn't bad," said Harry, "but there's definite room for improvement." Zacharias Smith glared at him. "Let's try again." He moved off around the room again, stopping here and there to make suggestions. Slowly, the general performance improved. He avoided going near Cho and her friend for a while, but after walking twice around every other pair in the room, felt he could not ignore them any longer. "Oh, no," said Cho rather wildly as he approached. "Expelliarmus! I mean, Expellimelius. Sorry, Marietta." Her curly-haired friend's sleeve had caught fire. Marietta extinguished it with her own wand and glared at Harry as though it was his fault. "You made me nervous. I was doing all right before then," Cho told Harry ruefully. "That was quite good," Harry lied. But when she raised her eyebrows, he said, "Well, no, it was lousy, but I know you can do it properly. I was watching from over there." She laughed. Her friend Marietta looked at them rather sourly and turned away. "Don't mind her," Cho muttered. "She doesn't really want to be here, but I made her come with me. Her parents have forbidden her to do anything that might upset Umbridge. You see,
her mum works for the ministry.
What about your parents? Asked Harry.
Well, they've forbidden me to get on the wrong side of Umbridge too, said Cho, drawing herself up proudly. But if they think I'm not going to fight you-know-who after what happened to Cedric...
She broke off, looking rather confused, and an awkward silence fell between them.
Terry Boots' wand went whizzing past Harry's ear and hit Alicia Spinett hard on the nose.
"Well, my dad is very supportive of any anti-ministry action," said Luna Lovegood proudly from just behind Harry. Evidently, she had been eavesdropping on his conversation while Justin Finch-Fletchley attempted to disentangle himself from the robes that had flown up over his head.
"He's always saying he'd believe anything of Fudge. I mean, the number of goblins Fudge has had assassinated. And, of course, he uses the Department of Mysteries to develop terrible poisons, which he secretly feeds to anybody who disagrees with him. And then there's his umgubular slash-kilter."
"Don't ask," Harry muttered to Cho as she opened her mouth, looking puzzled. She giggled.
"Hey, Harry!" Hermione called from the other end of the room. "Have you checked the time?"
He looked down at his watch and was shocked to see it was already 9:10, which meant they needed to get back to their common rooms immediately, or risk being caught and punished by Filch for being out of bounds. He blew his whistle. Everybody stopped shouting Expelliarmus, and the last couple of wands clattered to the floor.
"Well, that was pretty good," said Harry, "but we've overrun. We'd better leave it here. Same time, same place next week?"
"Sooner," said Dean Thomas eagerly, and many people nodded in agreement.
Angelina, however, said quickly,
"The Quidditch season's about to start. We need team practices too."
"Let's say next Wednesday night then," said Harry.
"We can decide on additional meetings then. Come on, we'd better get going." He pulled out the Marauder's map again and checked it carefully for signs of teachers on the 7th floor. He let them all leave in 3s and 4s, watching their tiny dots anxiously to see that they returned safely to their dormitories. The Hufflepuffs to the basement corridor that also led to the kitchens, the Ravenclaws to a tower on the west side of the castle, and the Gryffindors along the corridor to the fat lady's portrait.
"That was really, really good, Harry," said Hermione, when finally it was just her, Harry and Ron who were left.
"Yeah, it was," said Ron enthusiastically, as they slipped out of the door and watched it melt back into stone behind them.
"Did you see me disarm Hermione, Harry?"
"Only once," said Hermione, stung. "I got you loads more than you got me."
"I did not only get you once, I got you at least 3 times. Well, if you're counting the one where you tripped over your own feet and knocked the wand out of my hand."
They argued all the way back to the common room. But Harry was not listening to them. He had one eye on the Marauder's map, but he was also thinking of Cho, saying he made her nervous.
Chapter 19. The Lion and the Serpent. Harry felt as though he were carrying some kind of talisman inside his chest over the following 2 weeks, a glowing secret that supported him through Umbridge's classes, and even made it possible for him to smile blandly as he looked into her horrible, bulging eyes. He and the D.A. were resisting her under her very nose, doing the very thing she and the ministry most feared, and whenever he was supposed to be reading Wilbert Slinkhard's book during her lessons, he dwelled instead on satisfying memories of their most recent meetings, remembering how Neville had successfully disarmed Hermione, how Colin Creevy had mastered the impediment jinx after 3 meetings' hard effort, how Parvati Patil had produced such a good reductor curse that she had reduced the table carrying all the sneakerscopes to dust. He was finding it almost impossible to fix a regular night of the week for the DA meetings, as they had to accommodate 3 separate teams' Quidditch practices, which were often rearranged due to bad weather conditions. But Harry was not sorry about this,
he had a feeling that it was probably better to keep the timing of their meetings unpredictable. If anyone was watching them, it would be hard to make out a pattern. Hermione soon devised a very clever method of communicating the time and date of the next meeting to all the members, in case they needed to change it at short notice, because it would look suspicious if people from different houses were seen crossing the Great Hall to talk to each other too often. She gave each of the members of the DA a fake galleon. Ron became very excited when he first saw the basket and was convinced she was actually giving out gold. "You see the numerals around the edge of the coins?" Hermione said, holding one up for examination at the end of their fourth meeting. The coin gleamed fat and yellow in the light from the torches. "On real galleons, that's just a serial number, referring to the goblin who cast the coin. On these fake coins, though, the numbers will change to reflect the time and date of the next meeting. The coins will grow hot when the date changes, so if you're carrying them in a pocket, you'll be able to feel them. We take one each, and when Harry sets the date of the next meeting, he'll change the numbers on his coin. And because I've put a protean charm on them, they'll all change to mimic his." A blank silence greeted Hermione's words. She looked around at all the faces upturned to her, rather disconcerted. "Well, I thought it was a good idea," she said uncertainly. "I mean, even if Umbridge asked us to turn out our pockets, there's nothing fishy about carrying a galleon, is there? But, well, if you don't want to use them..." "You can do a protean charm," said Terry Boot. "Yes," said Hermione. "But that's N.E.W.T. standard, that is," he said weakly. "Oh," said Hermione, trying to look modest. "Oh, well, yes, I suppose it is." "How come you're not in Ravenclaw?" he demanded, staring at Hermione with something close to wonder. "With brains like yours." "Well, the Sorting Hat did seriously consider putting me in Ravenclaw during my sorting," said Hermione brightly, "but it decided on Gryffindor in the end. So, does that mean we're using the galleons?" There was a murmur of assent, and everybody moved forwards to collect one from the basket. Harry looked sideways at Hermione. "You know what these remind me of?" "No, what's that?" "The Death Eater's scars. Voldemort touches one of them, and all their scars burn, and they know they've got to join him." "Well, yes," said Hermione quietly. "That is where I got the idea. But you'll notice I decided to engrave the date on bits of metal, rather than on our members' skin." "Yeah, I prefer your way," said Harry, grinning, as he slipped his galleon into his pocket. "I suppose the only danger with these is that we might accidentally spend them." "Fat chance," said Ron, who was examining his own fake galleon with a slightly mournful air. "I haven't got any real galleons to confuse it with." As the first Quidditch match of the season, Gryffindor versus Slytherin, drew nearer, their DA meetings were put on hold because Angelina insisted on almost daily practices. The fact that the Quidditch Cup had not been held for so long added considerably to the interest and excitement surrounding the forthcoming game. The Ravenclaws and Hufflepuffs were taking a lively interest in the outcome, for they, of course, would be playing both teams over the coming year, and the heads of house of the competing teams, though they attempted to disguise it under a decent pretense of sportsmanship, were determined to see their own side victorious. Harry realized how much Professor McGonagall cared about beating Slytherin when she abstained from giving them homework in the week leading up to the match. "I think you've got enough to be getting on with at the moment," she said loftily. Nobody could quite believe their ears until she looked directly at Harry and Ron and said grimly, "I've become accustomed to seeing the Quidditch Cup in my study, boys, and I really don't want to have to hand it over to Professor Snape. So use the extra time to practice, won't you?" Snape was no less obviously partisan. He had booked the Quidditch pitch for Slytherin practice so often that the Gryffindors had difficulty getting on it to play. He was also turning a deaf ear to the many reports of Slytherin attempts to hex Gryffindor players in the corridors. When Alicia Spinett turned up in the hospital wing with her eyebrows growing so thick and fast they obscured her vision and obstructed her mouth, Snape insisted that she must have attempted a hair-thickening charm on herself, and refused to listen to the 14 eyewitnesses who insisted they had seen the Slytherin keeper, Miles Bletchley, hit her from behind with a jinx while she worked in the library. Harry felt optimistic about Gryffindor's chances. They had, after all, never lost to Malfoy's team. Admittedly, Ron was still not performing to Wood's standard, but he was working extremely hard to improve. His greatest weakness was a tendency to lose confidence after he had made a blunder. If he let in one goal, he became flustered and was therefore likely to miss more. On the other hand, Harry had seen Ron make some truly spectacular saves when he was on form. During one memorable practice, he had hung one-handed from his broom and kicked the quaffle so hard away from the goal hoop that it soared the length of the pitch and through the centre hoop at the other end. The rest of the team felt this save compared favourably with one made recently by Barry Ryan, the Irish international keeper, against Poland's top chaser, Ladislav Zamoyski. Even Fred had said that Ron might yet make him and George proud, and that they were seriously considering admitting he was related to them, something they assured him they had been trying to deny for 4 years. The only thing really worrying Harry was how much Ron was allowing the tactics of the Slytherin team to upset him before they even got onto the pitch. Harry, of course, had endured their snide comments for over 4 years, so whispers of, "Hey, Potty, I heard Warrington sworn to knock you off your broom on Saturday," far from chilling his blood, made him laugh. "Warrington's aim so pathetic, I'd be more worried if he was aiming for the person next to me," he retorted, which made Ron and Hermione laugh and wiped the smirk off Pansy Parkinson's face. But Ron had never endured a relentless campaign of insults, jeers and intimidation. When Slytherins, some of them seventh years and considerably larger than he was, muttered as they passed in the corridors, "Got your bed booked in the hospital wing, Weasley?" he didn't laugh, but turned a delicate shade of green. When Draco Malfoy imitated Ron dropping the quaffle, which he did whenever they came within sight of each other, Ron's ears glowed red, and his hands shook so badly that he was likely to drop whatever he was holding at the time, too. October extinguished itself in a rush of howling winds and driving rain, and November arrived, cold as frozen iron, with hard frosts every morning and icy draughts that bit at exposed hands and faces. The skies and the ceiling of the great hall turned a pale, pearly grey. The mountains around Hogwarts were snow-capped, and the temperature in the castle dropped so low that many students wore their thick, protective dragon-skin gloves in the corridors between lessons. The morning of the match dawned bright and cold. When Harry awoke, he looked round at Ron's bed and saw him sitting bolt upright, his arms around his knees, staring fixedly into space. "You all right?" said Harry. Ron nodded, but did not speak. Harry was reminded forcibly of the time Ron had accidentally put a slug-vomiting charm on himself. He looked just as pale and sweaty as he had done then, not to mention as reluctant to open his mouth. "You just need some breakfast," Harry said bracingly. "Come on." The great hall was filling up fast when they arrived, the talk louder and the mood more exuberant than usual. As they passed the Slytherin table, there was an upsurge of noise. Harry looked round and saw that, in addition to the usual green and silver scarves and hats, every one of them was wearing a silver badge in the shape of what seemed to be a crown. For some reason, many of them waved at Ron, laughing uproariously. Harry tried to see what was written on the badges as he walked by, but he was too concerned to get Ron past their table quickly to linger long enough to read them. They received a rousing welcome at the Gryffindor table, where everyone was wearing red and gold. But far from raising Ron's spirits, the cheers seemed to sap the last of his morale. He collapsed onto the nearest bench, looking as though he were facing his final meal. "I must have been mental to do this," he said in a croaky whisper. "Mental!"
"Don't be thick," said Harry firmly, passing him a choice of cereals. "You're going to be fine. It's normal to be nervous."
"I'm rubbish," croaked Ron. "I'm lousy. I can't play to save my life. What was I thinking?"
"Get a grip," said Harry sternly. "Look at that save you made with your foot the other day. Even Fred and George said it was brilliant."
Ron turned a tortured face to Harry.
"That was an accident," he whispered miserably. "I didn't mean to do it. I slipped off my broom when none of you were looking, and when I was trying to get back on, I kicked the quaffle by accident."
"Well," said Harry, recovering quickly from this unpleasant surprise, "a few more accidents like that, and the game's in the bag, isn't it?" Hermione and Ginny sat down opposite them, wearing red and gold scarves, gloves, and rosettes.
"How are you feeling?" Ginny asked Ron, who was now staring into the dregs of milk at the bottom of his empty cereal bowl, as though seriously considering attempting to drown himself in them.
"He's just nervous," said Harry.
"Well, that's a good sign. I never feel you perform as well in exams if you're not a bit nervous," said Hermione heartily.
"Hello?"
said a vague and dreamy voice from behind them. Harry looked up. Luna Lovegood had drifted over from the Ravenclaw table. Many people were staring at her, and a few were openly laughing and pointing. She had managed to procure a hat shaped like a life-size lion's head, which was perched precariously on her head.
"I'm supporting Gryffindor," said Luna, pointing unnecessarily at her hat. "Look what it does."
She reached up and tapped the hat with her wand. It opened its mouth wide and gave an extremely realistic roar that made everyone in the vicinity jump.
"It's good, isn't it?" said Luna happily. "I wanted to have it chewing up a serpent, to represent Slytherin, you know, but there wasn't time. Anyway, good luck, Ronald."
She drifted away. They had not quite recovered from the shock of Luna's hat before Angelina came hurrying towards them, accompanied by Katie and Alicia, whose eyebrows had mercifully been returned to normal by Madame Pumphrey.
"When you're ready," she said, "we're going to go straight down to the pitch, check out conditions, and change."
"We'll be there in a bit," Harry assured her.
"Ron's just got to have some breakfast."
It became clear after 10 minutes, however, that Ron was not capable of eating anything more, and Harry thought it best to get him down to the changing rooms. As they rose from the table, Hermione got up too, and taking Harry's arm, she drew him to one side.
"Don't let Ron see what's on those Slytherin's badges," she whispered urgently.
Harry looked questioningly at her, but she shook her head warningly. Ron had just ambled over to them, looking lost and desperate.
"Good luck, Ron," said Hermione,
standing on tiptoe and kissing him on the cheek.
"And you, Harry."